The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Trust me, hyperbole is not my favorite form of expression, but the casino dynamics are already afoot today. Complemented by erasing the lower bound for rates, if that's what we're doing, going to erase the lower bound and give latitude to take the Fed funds rate deeply negative, it introduces a radically different speculative backdrop than we've seen, I can't even say for a long, long time, maybe ever.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we just got out of a meeting with some people who are very special to us. You know, your dad and mom have been working with orphanages for years. Your personal assistant, who worked for you and actually had worked for the company for quite a while, ultimately became someone who lives in an orphanage and runs an orphanage in India. And she and her husband and their kids, they came to visit us, tell us the update of what's going on with India. I think it's an amazing place to be able to work here and see the history. What did she say? 17, 18 years of history leading up to being in India and helping hundreds of kids, getting them out of trafficking, that type of thing.
We went from that meeting to her oldest son sitting in the seat that I'm in right now.
He's what, 8, 9 years old?
And he looked over my notes and looked into the mic and started reading. And he wanted to talk about inflation, and he wanted to talk about inflation targeting. And it's amazing. You know, he's just following through the outline, because that's what I do each week, on a Tuesday morning is put together an outline so that we have some structure to our conversation.
When he walked into the room, he said, "Wow, is this a studio?" And he put the headsets on. I said, "Go ahead and put the headsets on." And he started, you know, we were doing a mic test. So you said, "Just go ahead and read into the mic." And he started reading some of your notes.
I was fantastic. And you just never know where things start for someone. You know, will he be a broadcaster in India someday? Or it was really priceless.
He seemed thrilled to record, but it reminds me of something you just told me. You were watching a show about people who make the decision young to become an astronaut. That's a decision that sometimes occurs about that same age, 8 or 9, and then it's a commitment that may not pay off for decades, if ever.
I watched a masterclass this weekend while I was on the bike trainer, and it was on space travel, and it was fascinating. But 26 years of hard work and dedication and commitment and sacrifice starting at the age of 9. And finally, this man becomes an astronaut. And it started very young. And what are the exposures that set us on a life trajectory? I think it's worth considering the people in our lives and just those small moments. Because as I was watching this little mic check this morning, I thought, maybe this is it. Maybe this is one of those things that you define, you know, bright lights in the big city. You define what ultimate trajectory is by some vision, dream, or perception at a young age. And you say, yep, that's what I want.
Well, Dave, you had mentioned that this astronaut, as he was clearing the tower on his first ride to space, well, that was 20 some odd years later. And he reminisced at that moment, just going, that's how long it took.
I've been working on this and waiting for this moment for 26 years.
You know, one of the things that you and I've talked about recently is just how much noise there is. You know, when you're riding the trainer or you're running on the treadmill, you said Fox News was on the other day. Actually, there were 3 televisions in the sports club that you were in, and they had the news on it. You were just reading the closed caption words on the bottom and realizing that even though there were a lot of lights and cameras and voices and everything else, with the volume turned down, the actual information that's coming across is sparse and repetitive, and actually there's not much to it, and it just drones on and on and on. It's very hard these days to find signal or new information in all the noise.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I'm sitting there, and minute by minute is going by, and it's painfully slow, and I can't figure out why. And maybe it was because it was early in the morning. Maybe it was because I was on the treadmill for quite a while. But it was minute by minute torture. And I realized later that when you take away the noise and literally the sound effects and all the things that go on to create this production, which is news today, that actually there wasn't much meaning. There wasn't a lot of content. And so as we've talked about noise and signal, there wasn't a lot of signal. And I think that's one of the things that was just, it's very obvious. If you're just reading the message and ignoring everything else, which when you're on a treadmill and you're trying to focus on just the words, all of a sudden everything else is pushed aside and it's vacuous. It's empty. I got to compare CNN on one screen and Fox News on another. There really wasn't much difference qualitatively.
Just droning on, you know, you and I both met a man a few years ago who works for the Defense Department, and he's a stochastic mathematician engineer. And what he does, he couldn't talk much about what he does, but really you could discern after he gave a few hints that he works out the mathematics of cutting through the noise of the enemy and just finding that pure signal. One of the things you and I talked about last night when we were meeting about the commentary is that we want to make a commitment. If you're going to listen as a listener for 45 minutes, maybe even longer, that's critical, important time in your life that you'll never get back. And so we want to make sure that what we're bringing to you as an audience, speaking to the listeners now, is signal and not noise.
And I don't know that we always deliver on that, but it's certainly our intention to try.
Well, okay. So I want to bring something new up. All right. Because you had sort of a play on words, Dave. AIDS is the cure, not the disease. Now you're going to have to explain that a little bit.
All right. That's
what this week's commentary, yeah, Hopefully this week's signal is to the listener.
AIDS is the cure, not the disease. That's AITS, not AIDS. But so inflation persisting below the 2% target, that remains a Fed and central bank concern, a fixation. And it's almost inconceivable how this could be the case to them when employment numbers are the strongest in 50 years and wages are rising ever so slowly. So they are now creatively on the hunt for how to maintain the target rate, which for them is this 2% number, through the ebbs and flows of the economy. And, you know, what I love about this is that there is, in the ebbs and flows of the economy and their inability to sort of manage that, there is an implicit admission that the business cycle exists. And that is not under their thumb. So that point is amazing.
Okay, so you're talking, the AIDS that you're talking about is average inflation targeting.
That's right. So in preview, we're going to explore average inflation targeting, or AIT. AIDS is, I'm going to pronounce it for the program. And you're supposed to be excited to receive this.
Well, as we've talked about, a past guest of ours and hopefully a future guest, Tomáš Sedláček, he wrote the book, The Economics of Good and Evil. And he talked about how cycles, you have rises and falls, but we have become almost worshipers of continual growth. That's part of this inflation targeting, isn't it?
Well, it's an utterly fascinating thing because Tomáš Sedláček points out that we are now going into debt just for excess consumption. We're not going into debt to sort of save the day. Like, this is not a rescue mission, and therefore we need a little credit extended.
Just
this
keep is, spending money, please.
Right. It's so that we can create problems like obesity, right? It's not that we're underfed, we're overfed, and thus we have diet problems. A food crisis is not, in this era, not having enough food, it's having too much. And he would say the same thing about credit. We've pursued growth to such an extreme that we've lost track of what normal and healthy is, to the point where now we look at overcapacity, global overcapacity.
Well, if you build it, they will come is sort of an attitude sometimes. Like, look at China, how many things China built that never was occupied.
But this is one of the reasons why inflation targeting has failed. When we think about global overcapacity, having the means of production that exceeds global demand, as a structural impediment to lifting consumer price inflation. That's one aspect. We've also talked about the post-Cold War peace dividend, which persists to this day, and it stems from the inclusion of Russia and China and Eastern Europe into the global workforce. And what that did is it had the effect of holding wages to a lower level and thereby increasing corporate profitability on the one hand, but depressing wage growth. So the depression of wage growth and overcapacity, structural overcapacity, these are two real factors fighting against the Fed and other central banks in their aspiration of behind the scenes. What it really is nominal GDP growth targeting.
Okay, but how twisted is it really in the scheme of things where we're trying to raise the prices of everything all the time? That's part of a model, I know, that's just treated as the truth. But isn't it sort of, shouldn't we have really benefited from falling prices versus continually trying to figure out a way to keep prices rising?
Yeah, and there is a benefit to falling prices. I mean, there is, consumer price deflation is not something to be afraid of. What we could or should be afraid of is asset price deflation. That's certainly the boogeyman that this world central banks are trying to fight is asset price deflation. In a world of so much debt, if you begin to see a recalibration of the value of those assets, remember, debt is some banker's asset.
So do they want inflation for inflation's sake?
This is, again, we come back to this issue of inflation. When they say they're targeting inflation, what they're really targeting is nominal GDP growth. Mm. That's what they're targeting. So inflation is just a part of the equation. Do they want inflation for inflation's sake? Good question. No. They want it for what a series of equations suggest about inflation, that it boosts nominal GDP growth. Right. So, and of course, go downstream. It also boosts, if you're increasing nominal GDP growth, you're also increasing tax revenues, which helps when you're massively in debt and need to increase your revenue each year. So how does this work?
So what we're talking about is something new, average inflation targeting versus inflation targeting. Sounds like whack-a-mole to me, where they're basically saying if it's too low, we're going to do this. If it's too high, we're going to do this, but we're going to go beyond. We're going to create an extreme so that we can average the inflation at whatever, 2%. Is that what they're saying?
That's right. So instead of having a set target, now you can sort of get an average to get the number. According to two economists that have previously worked at the Federal Reserve and now do research and write for the Peterson Institute, AIT, or average inflation targeting, is seen to offer a crucial innovation. This is what they say. When inflation has been running below the target rate, it would have the Fed aim for above the target inflation in the future in order to bring average inflation up towards the target. Now, this, of course, gets interesting. It's interesting to me, at least. If we assume that the Fed rate can be cut to accommodate the markets and the economy, when the markets and the economy are under stress, that's where the funds rate, the Fed funds rate, where it's at tells you how much firepower you have from a rate cut perspective, right? So now we're accustomed to additional tools like large-scale asset purchases and other kinds of stimulants or stabilization tools, but rate cuts are a huge factor, a huge tool that the Fed intends to use to sort of resolve the next recession.
Well, how powerful tool is it when you're down to 2% already, Dave?
I mean, do we
even have room to maneuver unless they're talking about negative rates?
Yeah, Fed funds sitting close to 2%. You get the 10-year treasury well under 2%. You only have about 200 basis points to cut to get to what is known as the effective lower bound, or zero, basically. Mm-hmm. You probably recall from past episodes of distress that the average that the Fed has, in fact, cut rates, this is, again, in the middle of each of the last recessions, has been about 500 basis points. That's five full percentage points.
Which we don't have without going negative three.
That's right. So up to this point, the limiting factor has been the ELB, right? That's the acronym for effective lower bound. And the implication of playing with an average inflation target is that you expand the range not only for inflation, it may be a higher number to get to an average. Today, let's say it's 1.8%. Well, to get to two, you might have to overshoot your target to get to the average. But it's also, the implication is what you consider to be the effective lower bound.
Okay, right? So what you're saying, okay, we can call zero ELB. Let's say I came in and I worked all day and I went to get my paycheck and it was zero. Well, you might have an acronym for it, but to me, it's still zero.
So to have the conversation on AIT, on AIDS, as it were, is to open the theoretical model to not only reconsidering zero as the limiting number in your interest rate policy. And again, this is kind of like the economist's game of limbo.
How low can you go?
Exactly. but also, it brings in what behavioral modifications would be required amongst savers for that policy move to be implemented across the financial system.
Well, do you remember that IMF report that you published back in, what was it, June, that the IMF had written talking about behavioral modification? If you read all 83 pages, which most people didn't, toward the end, it was all about how do we sell this to people because they're not going to like it otherwise.
And the fixation was on commercial banks. So beware the commercial bank complicity in helping to orchestrate the next crisis period Fed policies.
In other words, it won't be the Fed this time. It'll be actual individual banks.
Yeah. So as one client recently experienced, getting your money out of a large institution, Vanguard comes to mind, $6 trillion in assets. You wouldn't think that'd be an issue, but it can be a challenge even under the best of circumstances. No stress and strain today. You would think a wire transfer is a straightforward request, but not when the institution prefers to maintain control of the asset. So I come back to this issue. Beware the commercial bank complicity in helping to orchestrate the next crisis period of Fed policies.
Well, and this brings us back to signal versus noise. You have to find out and pick who's going to actually go through the news for you and pick what you should be reading. Not Fox News, not ABC, not CNN. I think about Doug Noland. I mean, Doug Noland is someone that you have read for decades, and now you've hired, and he picks through what you read, lot of what you read.
Yeah, you know, for many years, I would go to prudentbear.com, and he managed that site and would publish this your sort of curated list of articles that were pointing to issues that you needed to be aware of. If you're balancing risk and reward as an investor, how do you, it's pretty easy to balance the reward side of the equation.
Right.
But understanding the current risks in the marketplace, sometimes that is more, it's just ignored by most investors because you want the good news. How am I going to make money today? What have you done for me lately?
Well, how often do we sit down and ask each other, what have you been reading? See, you have to have a few people in your life where you can ask that question and then go read what they read.
So Doug Noland, who provides a healthy risk management perspective to all our asset management decisions and also manages our tactical short product, which I think should be a consideration for anyone concerned with bubble dynamics and financial market frailty. It's a phenomenal product, but he does all of us a very valuable service every week, compiling a series of articles and references for the market's activities that day. And then through the Credit Bubble Bulletin, a summation of what has happened that week. And this informs the conversations that we have internally, both when we're discussing the reward-oriented allocations within our portfolios, but also the risk-oriented mitigation decisions, which are an ongoing part of our process.
Well, and the beauty
it's very helpful.
You
it's very
share
helpful.
That. You share that with anybody who wants it. I mean, we have it on the site.
Yeah, so one of the articles that he posted, and I think you should be going to mwealthm.com. That's our wealth management website, MWealthM website. I think you should do this every day. Get these linked articles. It's a massive time saver. Financial Times, CNBC, Reuters, Wall Street Journal, New York Times. You get the best curated source of information imaginable. I would take Doug Noland's posts over Matt Drudge any day of the week. And in fact, I do. So Doug posts a Reuters article this last week from the 9th. Reuters the 9th discussing the Federal Reserve Vice Chairman Richard Clarida's comments on a current review of the monetary policy strategy and the framework being used by the Fed. And there's an anticipation here, the anticipation of announcements of a shift in strategy likely by mid-year.
Do you think that's going to be, instead of inflation targeting, this new AIT
that's
average?
That's exactly what
targeting?
It is. The shift is described as evolutionary, not revolutionary. Read the article from Reuters. And the FOMC has been discussing, they've been having discussions about switching inflation targeting to average inflation targeting, that is AIT.
Okay, so for the listener who goes, this sounds really boring, but what we're telling you is this, overshooting, okay, what they're basically saying is we can use whatever interest rate, even deep negative interest rates, to get inflation to where we want it.
Right, so you're saying to yourself, there's a reason you're talking about AIDS today. You hung on long enough to find out why. Thank you for sticking with us. The article notes Chairman Powell saying this, this would represent an important regime shift for the central bank. The purpose would be to correct the downward bias in inflation and reset expectations at a number closer or above 2% so that the actual target can be hit. Okay, so here's my interpretation of it. If you were at a gun range, at this point, you might adjust the sights, right? If you were you or me and recognize, okay, we're not hitting the target, so something's off here. Or you could just recognize you're a terrible shot and go home.
Sure.
Can't hit the target, maybe move the target closer, whatever. The Fed is in essence saying, we're just going to aim far enough above the target that the arc of interest rate destiny will be bound to find its target. Just aim high. Aim high.
Mm.
You can almost hear the enthusiasm as if you were at sort of a high school commencement ceremony. Aim high and you'll hit your target.
Yeah. The problem is when you're aiming high, you're basically stealing deposits of the depositors because you're going negative on the interest rates to do that.
that.
Well, that's right. Brookings Institute quotes Fed official John Williams on AIDS, and I quote, the central bank purposefully aims to achieve an above-target inflation rate in good times when the lower bound is not a constraint. Properly designed and implemented, such an overshoot can offset the inflation undershoot during bad times so that the longer run average inflation rate and inflation expectations are in line with the target.
Okay, so I know we talk about analogies, but you're talking raising the aim, at a shooting range, and I think about shooting an apple off someone's head. It works fine as long as you hit the apple, right? but actually, what you're talking about, if you're aiming high, it's a little bit like saying, "Hey, stand with the apple between your knees. We're going to aim high, but trust me,
it's a little uncomfortable." So why do we reference the lower bound? Why do we reference commercial banking? Why do we reference interest rates and trajectory of interest rates when we're really talking about inflation? Very excellent question, Watson. Mm. I love answering my own questions. Because as you look through the research, and this is an excellent paper, highly recommend, if you're interested in this stuff, to read it. The Peterson Institute put together a 13-page policy brief. This is back in November 2019. And their conclusion is that AIT is not a good idea. But what you'll find is that the implied federal funds rate, looking back at the 2008 and 2009 timeframe, in order to revive an economy and stimulate average inflation to the 2% target, would have taken the federal funds rate from, drumroll, prior to the global financial crisis, positive 5%, to the middle of the crisis, they would have had to take rates negative 5%, and at least on one measure, nearly 7%.
That's a 10% swing. And the problem is, to do that, that is interest coming out of depositors' deposits. In other words, you're negative at that point.
Well, we've discussed a world of negative rates, and you've even got right now some European countries who are throwing in the towel on their negative rate policy, saying they haven't worked as effectively hoped, but it's not as if that memo was circulated to the Fed. Average interest targeting would justify deeply negative rates to aid in counteracting deflationary forces in the economy and revive that inflationary trend.
We've talked about vaulted as an option for a savings account. Part of it, vaulted is really just owning gold as a savings account where you can move from your bank account into gold and then back out of gold into the savings account. I would imagine before a deeply negative interest rate type of environment, you'd want to be sitting in vaulted, not in savings.
Right. Vaulted.com's the sole purpose was to create a reliable destination for savings. That's exactly right. So welcome to a brave new world, young depositor, where, the Federal Reserve is talking about AIDS as, again, a cure for your problem and not a disease, when in fact part and parcel to this is, according to their modeling, and this is the Peterson Institute's modeling, you would have needed a negative 5 to 7% Fed funds rate to get to your 2% inflation target. This is massively insane. Oh, welcome to a brave new world, old goat that thought retirement would be easy.
Well, and this isn't just people who are managing their own funds. Think about it. If you're an insurance company, an annuity promising 3%, 4%. How do you promise 3 or 4% when you've got a Federal Reserve that can say, hey, look, we can take it negative 10 if we want?
No, but we already see the evidence in that a lot of your financial structures, banks in Europe and insurance companies in Europe, are paying a price. It's not just a question of net interest margin. When you're talking about no interest, NIM goes from net interest margin to no interest margin.
Mm.
You see, this is when you're dealing with zero, it is no interest margin. Interest rate risk. How do you do this? How do you manage, as an investor, how do you manage interest rate risk in a world where the Fed funds rate, the target rate, can pull rates down 1,000 basis points.
10%.
10%.
Wow.
And in theory, can go up that much as well, right? Should they, if you can imagine this, should normalization ever be allowed?
Okay, so let me ask you about volatility. Does it increase in this environment, or do they just kill it?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know, because these are market dynamics we haven't seen ever. So volatility is either the defining factor of the future, again, where interest rates can be up or down 1,000 basis points, and you're either making a killing or getting killed, and you don't really know because this is on a policy basis. This isn't sort of the market judgment about dynamics. It's an arbitrary decree from a policy meeting, right? So volatility is either the defining factor of the future, or we're on the cusp of killing volatility as we completely kill price discovery via central bank policy, quote unquote, evolution.
Well, as with all complex controls, it's both. Okay, so you kill volatility until it arrives. And then when it arrives, it's unmanageable.
With a vengeance. So yeah, there are implications. Number one, you've got volatility. Number two, you've got even greater asset price bubble dynamics. Number three, completing the shift that we've seen over the last 20 years, where being a long-term investor, you can't be. If you're going to be a long-term investor, you're going to be eviscerated. Only gamblers, high-stakes gamblers, are rewarded.
Okay, so for the person who fully understands what's going on and they say, you know, this is an unsustainable market, this debt is unsustainable, but guys, and I just heard this from a client last week. Yeah, I've had her as a client now for almost 30 years. And she says, you know what, Kevin? You're right. I'm right. But we've been wrong, because this whole thing has been lasting for a lot longer than we thought it would. So for the person who's listening and they're saying, yeah, you guys are right, we shouldn't be doing this, but the market's going to keep going up if they do. So what's your response to that?
My first response is that in a 30-year period, you've seen a 5x increase in the value of gold.
Oh, and she bought, and she's laughing. Yeah. But she stayed in the stock market, always mistrusting it.
Right. Well, okay, so the markets are completing this process of becoming a casino.
Yeah.
That's the reality. When the Fed describes AIDS as the cure, instead of diagnosing it as a sign and a symptom of disease, if you want to see a melt up in asset prices from here,
right,
AIDS is going to deliver it,
yeah,
along with the eventual collapse of the financial system. And I, trust me, hyperbole is not my favorite form of expression. I tend to hold it suspect most of the time. But the casino dynamics are already afoot today, complemented by erasing the lower bound for rates. If that's what we're doing, going to erase the lower bound and give latitude to take the Fed funds rate deeply negative, it introduces a radically different speculative backdrop than we've seen, I can't even say for a long, long time, maybe ever.
When we look at this, we have to say exactly what you're saying. Is there a disease here? What's the underlying cause for us to have to do AIT? What is that? I mean, is it a function of disease?
It was about 6 years ago that you and I traveled to Argentina.
Yeah.
And so we've talked in the program about Argentina and how one significant marker of structural economic decay and monetary madness is when shopkeepers are forced to become currency speculators and to survive have to exist in a parallel universe. So in Argentina, you have the blue market currency exchange rate that is parallel to the official rate. The official rate is only relevant to those who are still sucker enough to play by the rules. and frankly, whether they know it or not, they're getting gutted like fish. That's the old quote from the Congressional Register, 1958. Do you remember we had a conversation with Hunter Lewis?
Yeah, he wrote the book Where Keynes Went Wrong.
And he quotes Malcolm Bryan, who was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta back in the 1950s. 1957, he was quoted as saying, if a government policy of active or permissive inflation is to be a fact, we should have the decency to say to the money saver, hold still, little fish. All we intend to do is gut you.
Yeah, and that's exactly what AIT does.
So not only have we forgotten that inflation is not the same thing as price stability, that in itself is just an absurdity, and that inflation is not our friend, we are tempting ourselves with a mathematics that's believed to deliver heaven on earth. And ironically, it puts the final nail in the coffin for the average consumer, sending them directly to hell, not heaven.
I think of inflation or this AIT as a form of morphine. When you see a patient injected with morphine, whether they have cancer or maybe someone out on the battlefield that's been shot up pretty badly, a lot of times that's a sign that they're not going to make it. It's like, okay, we're going to make this as easy as possible to keep you as comfortable as possible. So let me ask you a question. Is it inflation to the rescue? Is this a form of morphine?
Yeah, and a part of this is based on misdiagnosis, because we're talking about credit expansion being a real issue here. I mean, if we're talking about inflation coming to the rescue, I think one of the things we're ignoring is the greatest contributing factor of all. Why can't we lift inflation? Why can't they reach a 2% target rate? And this is becoming the perennial malaise to GDP growth. We have too much debt to service and still have sufficient resources left over to direct towards economic activity. Okay, so I guess one of the things we have to factor in here is that a part of what we're counting as GDP growth today comes from government spending, government deficit spending. It keeps the growth numbers looking good, but it only layers on more weight for the economy to carry. This is an illness. So again, credit expansion is a part of the problem here. When you misdiagnose and you start saying, oh, well, we don't really know what it is, but we think we need to increase inflation in the system. Balderdash. That's balderdash. We're talking about, I mean, does it strike you as odd? Does it strike you at, again, this goes back to Sedlacek. Does it strike you as odd that our obsession with economic growth, whether that's just in very plain and simple terms, pain avoidance or not wanting to see the dark side of volatility or whatever, creating control of future outcomes. I mean, this all comes at a very high price.
Right.
And it's largely ignored. That cost is largely ignored by a class of unelected officials that have faith in what boils down to a couple of mathematical equations.
So you ask a question that reminds me of an analogy that you gave back in 2013, Dave. You were talking for a group of people, and we were in a large room, a large conference room, probably were, I don't know, 700 or 800 people there listening. And you explained what debt does to a system. Okay, the more debt that a system takes on, it's like carrying a bag of concrete. And you talked about running across the room from one side to the other if you had no debt, no concrete. You could do it. And then let's say I handed you a 40-pound bag of concrete.
You can still move from one side to the other.
You could do it. You'd be slower.
You just move slower.
Right. But if I hand you the second one, you could still do it.
I'm barely moving.
Yeah, but there's a point where if I hand you a third one or...
It's too much.
Yeah, exactly.
It's too much. And so, yeah, it's nothing for the central bank community to move towards quote unquote evolutionary. And again, they're not revolutionary measures, as Richard Clarita tells us.
Not to scare anybody.
And for the citizenry to think this is perfectly okay. Because look, we've got the deft hands, not the daft. We've got the deft hands holding the wheel. This is like captains of a great ship. And again, maybe Malcolm Bryan's right. Maybe these are not, switch analogies with me. Captain ship, maybe it's the dexterous hands holding the knife. And we are, in fact, the fish.
Well, and captains of a great ship. You remember that ship where that great captain of that great ship, it was a cruise liner?
2012?
Yeah, it was a cruise liner, and it beached, if I remember right.
Yeah,
it hit something, it was sinking.
The Costa Concordia, the Italian cruise ship, it ran aground in 2012. Credibility, it's an issue, right?
Yeah.
But
the captain got off the boat first, if I remember right.
Maybe the credibility issue is an issue of misplaced credibility by those in the investment community that want or need to believe in the almighty power of the PhD.
Well, if you recall with that Costa Concordia, the captain was one of the first guys to get off the ship. The captain's supposed to go down with the ship. There's a reason for that. What it is it's skin in the game, right? And the Federal Reserve, these PhDs, they only have enough skin in the game, actually, until they retire. So they're experimenting with a system that actually costs the depositors money and ultimately their savings.
Why does the cost of capital mean anything? Why do we care about that? Why, when we're talking about AIDS or, you know, average inflation targeting, why does it matter to us? Because when you lower the cost to borrow, you're taking skin out of the game.
Right.
You're taking skin out of the game. You're basically saying you can go to the casino and you've got nothing to lose here, right? So is it surprising to see bubble dynamics within the stock market and the bond market when you've changed the feel and the atmosphere to one of rank speculation? Again, this is why I think we are completing the process of becoming a financialized casino. Mm. And what is the Fed doing in the context of that? Again, misdiagnosis and their version of a cure is AIDS.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.